It's the second in a series of three lectures talking about heuristic evaluation. Last time we talked a little bit about why you would actually do a heuristic evaluation and some of the pros and cons of doing evaluations, and I also talked about the first three heuristics. Today we're going to talk about the next sort of three or four heuristics. So if you hit next slide, you can actually see that what I'm going to talk about is consistency and standards, error recovery, and error prevention. I'm also going to do a bit of a deep dive into three different kinds of interface consistency, and also do a little bit of a deeper dive into the kinds of errors that people can make. And I know we've talked about this in terms of slips and mistakes, but I'm just going to dive a little bit more into slips, and in particular, modes, and how we can actually use modes sometimes effectively. Next slide. So one of the things that you might expect, and this is sort of, makes a lot of sense, is to have some consistency and make sure that not only is the interface consistent with itself, but also consistent with the things that people are expecting, right? So you can do this by aligning your design with sort of platform standards, right? So when you decide to build an application for Windows, or you decide to build an application for OS X or iOS, there are certain platform guidelines that they give you. And the idea is that if everybody follows these platform guidelines, it'll be far easier for everybody else, all the users, to basically use everyone's tools. So try not to stick out if you don't need to. So essentially, this is talking about the principle of least surprise, right? Similar things should act similarly. Different things should look and act differently, right? So adhere to platform guidelines. Be consistent with your language, color, and wording and ordering. So a very important kind of consistency is wording. This is surprisingly easy to get wrong. The reason why it's easy to get wrong is because often we divide our interface into different chunks. Different people go ahead and implement those chunks, and there's very little oversight to make sure those chunks are working together in a meaningful and cohesive sort of way. So for example, using the same terms to your user interface makes a lot of sense. So if your interface in one place calls it a share price, and in another place calls it a stock price, and another place calls it a stock quote, a user who is not paying a lot of attention is going to think these three things mean something different. And even if they didn't, it is obviously better if you use one kind of one vocabulary to refer to all these three things, which are all referring to the same thing, I should say. Next slide. So one of the things you want to achieve is predictability. Your interface should be sort of predictable. People should know where things are going to be so they don't have to be thinking about it as they're kind of using it. Here are four different ways that we have seen sort of dialog boxes laid out. And some of these are more common than others. But obviously, if every single dialog box actually used the same standard, they'd be much easier to use, and we wouldn't have to think about it as hard, right? So I'm sure you've all had an experience where you were clicking through an interface and kind of the yes button was put in the wrong place, or the no button was put in the wrong place, and you just kind of click through, right? This is an example of sort of a broken consistency. They're being inconsistent perhaps with themselves or perhaps with other interfaces. Next slide. I think there are sort of three different kinds of consistency you need to be concerned about. One is internal consistency. So is the interface consistent with itself? This is sort of that wording consistency. This is important. Internal consistency is related to how well the thing just kind of works on its own. External consistency asks the question, is the design consistent with similar kinds of applications or applications on that platform? So external consistency is kind of related to learnability. So if it's consistent with other things out there, it's going to be easier to pick up and learn, right? So if I've been using Lotus 1-2-3 all my life, Excel comes along and it basically works the exact same way, that's going to be easy for me to pick up, right? Metaphorical consistency is a little bit trickier, but the question is asking, is the design consistent with a similar real-world entity or object? So think about that phone interface, right? That real phones interface. And there you have something. So sometimes being consistent with this thing is a good thing. I'll give you another example of external consistency, and this is across platforms. So on an OS X, hitting Control Open Apple N creates a new slide in PowerPoint. Whereas if you're using PowerPoint on Windows, Control M for mic creates a new slide. And so there's obviously no consistency here across the platforms, even though I'm using the exact same program. All right, next slide. So that's just sort of wrapping up on consistency. Next slide. Here's a quick example of sort of an obviously bad error box, right? Some kind of error. And you press OK. So the reason why this is next slide. So the reason why this is bad is because this is, well, it is kind of using plain language, kind of, but it's not really constructively suggesting a solution to the user as to how to actually fix that problem. And that's why that error dialogue is bad. So if you've ever had frustration with error dialogues, aside from having made an error at all, it's probably not really helping you in some way, right? So you want to construct your error dialogues in such a way that they, or you know, help people recover from error states by using plain language and using language that allows them to sort of figure out what is actually happening, right? So if you hit the next slide, here are just three really simple examples of error messages that were picked up on the web. And you can see why they are sort of bad error messages, right? Sorry, the request was unsuccessful. Like, okay, now what, right? Email address is improperly formatted or contains invalid characters. So which of the characters I have put in constitutes invalid, right? Or here's another one. The password you have entered is incorrect number of characters. Please enter a password 6 to 16 characters long using any combination of uppercase characters, lowercase characters, and numbers, and no symbols in this case. This one still sucks, but at least I know what to do now. Just a quick aside to make my life better in the future. I am hoping you will spread the gospel. If you are ever writing something that requires a password, you should absolutely allow any character. You should also allow any character length. There is no reason why you need to restrict the character length. If you absolutely must, then accept any character length and simply truncate my password. Right? Before you kind of pass it into your crypt function. There is no need to restrict my characters. Okay? If I am entering some insane password, you should allow me to do that. All right, next slide. Could not log in. Valid authentication credentials were not provided. This is a terrible, terrible error dialogue because it is just so nerdy. It is not written in language that people kind of use in everyday life. Yes, in some ways is it correct? Perhaps, and I can probably figure out what this means, but it does not make me feel like I am using a computer that I want to use. All right. Next slide. Okay, so this is an example of an interface that is just plain being bad. Right. Next slide after this. This is an error that we often see in many of the newer Web 2.0 systems. We don't have this problem happening too much anymore. But here you have a whole slew of error messages that are mostly unhelpful. Right. First of all, the error messages are too far away from where they can be corrected. So I need to actually do some sort of mapping between the error messages and actually where to fix the errors. The second thing is you're exposing here kind of internal system logic, and you don't need to. You should actually be exposing it in the language of the users. So, you know, look at this. Missing value for the required property bill zip code, right? Missing value for the required property bill city. Like, somebody could probably figure this out, but it does not feel like something that is very useful, right? So, are there other ways to design for this? Absolutely. You can highlight certain areas that need to be fixed. You can bring them to the right place. All of these different things. Next slide. So one of the tips that people talk about often, and this makes perfect sense, is to be polite. Don't blame the user, right? These messages should be worded in such a way to take as much blame away from the user and instead heap it right on the system itself. Help the user save face, right? The computer doesn't feel it. So anyway, as we've talked about a lot of the time, if there's a problem, it's a design interface problem, right? So blame it on the computer. Many words that are very common in sort of technical language, like aborted, fatal, illegal, forbidden, these are really sort of emotionally charged in human-to-human interaction, right? You would rarely use these words. So avoid them, and instead use sort of neutral language when you can. Next slide. If you take a peek at this and read through that error dialogue carefully, you will see the problem. This tooltip isn't strictly an error message, but this was something that actually shipped in a version of AutoCAD. It was obviously inserted as some kind of joke, but this sort of demonstrates a sort of attitude that you really don't want to be, an attitude and disdain for your users that you really don't want your system, or your programmers for that matter, to have. If they are, that's a really bad sign for the software that you are building, right? Next slide. So, some ways you can get around this. You can provide suggestions or examples on how to do this. You can also restate the user's input, right? So tell them what they have told you, and then tell them that they can't figure it out, or that you can't figure it out, right? In the please enter your email address, this is actually telling them what they need to do. Other ways to do this are actually to provide hints, right, on how to get this right. And so that's exactly what we're going to get into next. So if you slide down to slide number 21, there's a bunch of that are hidden here. If you're looking at the slide deck, it's kind of fun because you can see how my passwords are constructed. Probably not good for me, but you can take a peek. All right. So I've talked about this example before. But essentially, so you can kind of flip through the next three slides really quickly. I've talked about sort of cart return lanes, and when they're designed well, sort of subtle ones that I think are awesome, right? These ones I think are very overt, but what's great about these designs is that they help prevent errors. So this brings us to slide number 24. So you want a design to prevent errors from actually occurring, and the way you can do this is to actually eliminate error-prone conditions or present error users with a confirmation option before they commit into any kind of serious action. So if you're male, you'll probably get this. This is basically a urinal that has a picture of a fly in it, right? And people just kind of pee at this thing. This helps to reduce sort of splash issues. I found a funny example one time. Your scroll bar, when you're using it, if you've grabbed it and you've kind of scrolled too far, imagine that you had a situation where it every time you did that, it popped up dialog box that says, too far, too far, and you had to press OK each time, right? This is an error condition that doesn't need to be an error condition. Just don't let them scroll that far, right? You don't need to tell them anything about it. You can just hide that, right? It's OK. It's not going to hurt anybody, right? So I thought that was pretty funny. Okay, next slide. So some error prevention techniques on the small. You can actually allow people to, you can just gray out commands that aren't going to work right now, right? Another way you can do this is actually to allow for reduce typing errors simply through selection. I think that this sometimes gets abused as a technique. So here in this particular example, this is an abuse of it. So somebody's social security number, which is a 24689 digit number that they're asking for you to select from a drop-down box, that's a huge pain in the butt. But it is going to reduce errors, right? So you got to find times to use this that's appropriate, and if it's not, then don't use it, right? Some examples also happen on the next slide. So this is Hotwire, but any sort of hotel booking site is going to use something very similar. What's really cool about this is that you can start typing an address or typing a city, and it will provide you with suggestions for the city. So you can actually just kind of mouse down or press down a couple times, and it will help you get the city input correct, right? Something else is kind of neat about this one. It'll do a date picker while still allowing you to do text entry. So if you want to do text entry really quickly, it'll still work. But otherwise, you can actually use this date picker control, which is kind of neat. The other thing that's going to happen is rather than allowing you to, when you're hitting the checkout button, rather than allowing you to select a date that is before the check-in date, it actually grays out those ones, right? So that's kind of a nice little thing that the interface can do to help prevent errors. So I told you I was going to do a bit of a deep dive into different kinds of errors. And in particular, what I'm going to do is do a deep dive into slips. So we already know that the difference between slips and mistakes are that mistakes, you actually don't understand how the system works. And a slip, I've typically talked about as just kind of a little error that you make where you know what you're supposed to do, but you just kind of do the wrong thing. So here I want to make a subtle distinction between a slip and a lapse. A slip is a failure of execution, whereas this lapse is a failure of memory. So if you hit the next slide, you're going to see some more distinction into this slip space. Okay, so a capture error is one where a frequently done activity takes charge instead of the intended one. Right. So let's imagine that you live close to school, and you get everything ready, you leave your house, and then you end up walking to school instead of to the grocery store, which is what you had intended to do in the beginning. So what's happening here is you've got kind of two execution paths, and you just kind of veered off. All the steps leading up to kind of a decision point were the same, and then you just kind of veered off onto one rather than the other, right? So you veered off towards school instead of going to the grocery store. Description error is kind of similar, except for it's not necessarily the frequently done one that happens. So it's an intended action similar to than the others that are possible that is executed. So this is where you sort of pour orange juice into a cereal when you're tired, or you throw a shirt into the toilet instead of the hamper, right? Next slide. So loss of intention. So you basically forget the goal partway. So you walk into a room with all these plans that you have, and then you just kind of forget why you're there. So these things happen. Omissions due to interruption. And so you get your code out, and then somebody calls you, and then you go out without your coat because now you're busy with something else, and maybe you actually forgot your coat. Actually, you're busy getting your coat out, and you forgot to actually pick it up. Omissions due to an already satisfied goal. So we talked about this one in the past, but walking away from an ATM without your card, right? You got your money now, and then you start to walk away. You forget that actually you need to get your card too, because you've already had that goal satisfied. Or you walk away from the copier without the originals. Unsurprising when this happens, I think, because in part, your originals aren't visible anymore. So you've already got your goal, and you get the heck out of there. Next slide. Another example, different kind, is a mode error. So we talked about this last time in terms of why you want to kind of avoid modes. But the reason is that people will do actions in one mode thinking that they're in another mode, right? So looking for commands or menu options that aren't relevant because you're in the wrong mode, or you're clicking buttons and nothing's happening, so you click it a few more times because, again, your remote controller's in the wrong mode. You refer to a file that's in a different directory because you forgot that you were in that directory, right? So clicking through, and on the next slide. So one of the things that you want to do is obviously prevent capture and description slips. So one way you can do this is to avoid habitual action sequences that have identical prefixes. So in particular, what this means is make sure that the action steps to do different things have different steps to get there, and that it's not just the final step that is different, right? Avoid actions with very similar descriptions, right? So keep dangerous commands away from common ones. So here is an example of something that was part of the Excel interface, Outlook interface. Your email could have an attachment. You could right-click on it, and you could do these four options that are right next to each other. You can open it, print it, you could save it, or you can remove it from the email, right? So save as is right next to remove. That is insane. You would make that mistake anytime, right? Because the description is the exact same, right? Getting there is basically the exact same. It has identical prefixes is another way to talk about it. Next slide. If you take a look at a redesign of sort of the right-click drop-down that you get when you right-click in Notepad, they have done a thing where they actually separate out and they group logical operations with one another, and they've actually put a little spacer in between. Is it perfect? Maybe, maybe not. But in principle, this is better because you're actually preventing some certain kinds of slips from happening. All right, next slide. So we talked about mode errors, and last time I gave you some hints about how you can make modes kind of work. Here's some other ways you can actually do this, right? Okay, so one way is obviously getting rid of modes altogether. Last time what we talked about was making the mode visible. Another one is spring-loaded or having temporary modes or disjoint action sets in different modes. So an example of a spring-loaded mode or temporary mode is essentially the shift key. When you hit the shift key, it actually makes all your characters be bold or uppercase. And if you release it, it's got a spring-loaded action, so now it's not going to do that anymore, right? Disjoint action sets in different modes. So here is an example where some of the ribbon stuff on Microsoft gets this right. So basically, when you're in different modes, you can't do certain kinds of actions. And this makes it so that you don't get those mode errors where you're trying to do something, because everything, and this is, they've got the disjoint thing going on here, and also they've increased the visibility of the mode because they're sort of graying out a lot of different functions. Next slide. How do you avoid lapses? Well, you keep procedures really short. You make it so that the number of steps to complete certain actions to be very short. You try to minimize the number of interruptions that people are going to get when they're kind of manipulating your interface. Or you can do it where you have a forcing function. So, for example, with an automatic transition car, you must hold down the brake to shift out of park, right? Newer ATMs, what they do now is that they actually force you to take your card out of the machine before you can actually get your money. All right, so these are different ways that you can actually get around some of these lapses themselves. A common strategy to get around errors is this dialogue, right? The "Are you sure?" dialogue box, the confirmation dialogue box. These should be used in only the most sort of desperate of situations where there's absolutely nothing else you can do or you can't think of anything else, because they really, really reduce the efficiency of your interface. Right. The other problem is that if the confirmation dialog box comes up frequently for like a frequent action, people will sort of habituate to it and ignore it. And it'll just become part of the actions that they need to do to sort of get through and complete their goal. And so they won't actually read it. It'll just be in the way. So that's why you should use these things very, very sparingly. Okay, so next slide. Basically talked about error prevention in a bunch of different ways that you can actually design to prevent errors from happening and to eliminate error-prone conditions. With that, that's it for this time.